Welcome to Wake Up with Nubian Tigers Talk. Nubian Tigers are a group of people who met at Princeton University and have continued to be friends throughout the decades. The COVID-19 pandemic and the civil demonstrations following the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd by the police motivated us to harness our life experiences and professional expertise and contribute our voices to the broader discussion of the conditions of life throughout Black America. My name is Michelle Jacobs, and I'm with my co-host, Ray Smaltz. Before we get to today's guest, I'll turn it over to Ray.
Thanks so much, Michelle. And for those of you listening for the first time, the acronym WAKE, or WAKE, stands for Wisdom, Advice, Knowledge, and Engagement. And the UP is the abbreviation for Princeton University, only backwards. When the late civil rights icon and longtime Congressman John Lewis was only 23 years old, he delivered an inspiring speech at the historic March on Washington in 1963 and punctuated the end of it with, "Wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop and we will not and cannot be patient." This podcast aspires to wake up our listeners to some of the very same struggles within America today and across the globe.
In our last episode, we started a conversation about elections with Mary Nelson, class of 77, who worked for the administration of Jay Nixon, the former governor of Missouri. Today, we continue our discussion with Larry Hamm, a progressive community activist in Newark, New Jersey. We're now going to welcome Larry Hamm to the show. Larry entered Princeton with the class of 1975 and left almost immediately to return to his community-based work in Newark, New Jersey. He was appointed to the Newark Board of Education, making him the youngest member ever. Larry returned to Princeton and completed his degree in 1978. Some of you may know him as a DMU. After graduation, he returned to Newark and entered local politics. Among his positions, he served as district leader and president of the 24th District Assembly. Larry Hamm has been a relentless advocate for African-American people and the cause of human rights for more than 30 years. He helped organize the People's Organization for Progress, POP, an independent grassroots political organization that is active in the Newark and Northern New Jersey area. He is the current New Jersey state chairman of the POP, and Larry recently challenged Cory Booker in the race for New Jersey's Senate seat. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So we see that you've been invested in community activism and political activism for your entire life, beginning with being elected the youngest member of the local school board. How did that achievement shape your future political activism?
Right. Well, I've been an activist. I know that bio is says 30 years. It's quite dated. My activism starts with my appointment to the school board in 1971. So we almost up on a half a century, 50 years. It's 49 now, but next July will be 50 years from the date I was appointed to the school board. I was a high school student activist. I didn't start out that way. I was more like a regular kind of high school student, you know, I run track, do my homework, have a girlfriend. You know, I didn't have like great ambitions, but I did get elected as the leader of the student government at my high school, Arts High School. And there was a teacher strike in 1971. It was the longest teacher strike in the history of the country up until that time. And the law was if we missed 35 consecutive days of school, we wouldn't graduate. So as seniors, we had a vested interest in making our voices heard on the issue. I led my first walkout, march, and sit-in in the month of March, 1971. And about 400 of us walked out. We marched down to the hotel where the board and the union were negotiating. About 200 of us got in. We took over two floors of the hotel. It's the DoubleTree Hotel across the street from Penn Station in Newark. It was Hilton Gateway then. And as a result of that takeover, I met Mayor Kenneth A. Gibson. He was the one that came to us and implored us to end our sit-in. Every fire engine, every police car in Newark must have been outside of the gateway because, you know, we were off the reservation. We weren't supposed to be like downtown anyway, and out of school. But Gibson, I think, was generally concerned. He didn't want, he said he agreed with our goals. He didn't want any of us to get arrested. So we agreed and we ended our sit-in. To make a long story short, because it is very involved, but I won't go into the details here. But to make a long story short, 3 months later, just before I graduated Arts High, he sent an aide to my house on South 12th Street in Newark, the apartment where we lived at that time, and asked me if I wanted to be on the Board of Education. At that time, we had a Type 1 school board, which was appointed by the mayor. And on July 1st, 1971, I became the youngest fully voting school board member in the history of the United States. I was 17 years old. I wasn't 18, wouldn't be 18 until December. But interestingly, I just learned, because I'm working on a column that I'm writing for a newspaper. The same day that I was appointed to the school board, that was the date that the amendment to the Constitution was ratified that enabled 18-year-olds to vote in the United States of America. So I think Gibson, you know, probably had that on his mind and was trying to, you know, make inroads among younger voters and do something historical. And I was appointed to the school board July 1st, 1971, started Princeton. Actually, in August of 1971, was in the minority summer program where I met Jan Carew and other great people. But unfortunately, the work with the school board was too much for me. I couldn't do Princeton and do the school board at the same time. And so I withdrew from Princeton in probably October of 1971, end of October, beginning of November, and returned to Newark to finish my 3-year term on the Newark School Board. And so it was really in that period that I came into contact with probably the two individuals who had a really profound impact on shaping my political consciousness. One was Ken Gibson, the first African-American mayor to be elected in the 300-year history of Newark, New Jersey. He put me, by virtue of that appointment, he put me in the Black struggle. You know, he really put, like, physically put me in the struggle, because, you know, the school system was one of the institutions that the Black Liberation Movement, you know, really aimed to change. You know, one of the reasons we walked out, we had numerous demands, and one of them, of course, was for Black and Third World Studies at that time. The second person that had the impact on shaping my initial political consciousness was Amiri Baraka, then known as Imamu Baraka, who was the head of the Committee for Unified Newark, which was part of the National Congress of African Peoples. Baraka had played a major role in helping to get Ken Gibson elected in 1970. And these two individuals, who were very different, Gibson was essentially a Black liberal politician. You know, I mean, he was a pioneer in the sense that he was the first Black mayor of Newark, but he really was kind of in the mold of a conventional, you know, politician, a city machine type politician. Amiri Baraka was the revolutionary Black nationalist Pan-Africanist. And the following year, 1972, he was the one that gave me the name Adimu Tchanga, and which I still use till this day, although I never legally changed my name. But those two individuals had a profound impact on shaping my political consciousness. And those 3 years on the school board, really cast me as a militant long before I got to Princeton University. When my term was up on the school board, I had actually run for city council. I was also the youngest person to ever qualify to run for city council. I ran for city council in Newark at the age of 20. I did well, but didn't get elected. And that was good because, you know, if I had gotten elected, I probably wouldn't have returned to Princeton. And I think returning to Princeton was really good for me. It was good for me to complete, you know, the work on my undergraduate degree. So I did come back in 1974. I didn't come back the way I came the first time in 1971, because when I came back to Princeton, I was married, had a baby on the way. You know, it was a totally different, you know, kind of Larry Ham. And, you know, I had to deal with all that. But still, you know, I still was an activist after I got to Princeton in 1974.
Okay, and you also interacted with another legend in the civil rights movement, Dr. Ben Chavis, when you decided to follow the Freedom Ride route in 1986. So can you tell me why you decided to do that, and what was behind that? What were you guys trying to accomplish?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because the first time I actually met Ben Chavis was at Prince University. As you know, I was active, perhaps some would characterize me as one of the leaders of the anti-apartheid movement on Princeton's campus from 74 to 78. We formed the People's Front for the Liberation of Southern Africa to force Princeton to divest from companies doing business with South Africa. And after 66 days of protest and the takeover in 1978, Princeton did divest from a couple of companies. When I finished my undergraduate work, I actually became a graduate student at Princeton. I was in the doctoral program for 2 years. During the first year of graduate work, the anti-apartheid movement was still going, and we had new young leaders of that movement. But at that time, we brought Ben Chavis to Princeton to speak, and that's where he and I actually met. I believe it was in the spring of 1979. And at that time, he was executive director of the Commission for Racial Justice for the United Church of Christ. Well, anyway, after 2 years of graduate work, I left Princeton. I returned to Newark in 1980. The first organization you mentioned was the 24th District Assembly, which I helped to organize. And then there was the People's Energy Cooperative. We pulled together 400 families to buy their fuel oil together collectively rather than as individuals. And in doing so, get lower prices on fuel and on service contracts. And then in 1982, we formed the People's Organization for Progress, which observed its 38th anniversary in August.
Congratulations on that. Yes, how yes, exciting.
Yes. One thing people don't know is that I know everybody thinks I'm a full-time activist. Not so, you know, and most folks would never believe that I worked in any corporation, but I was actually a second-level manager at AT&T Information Systems for a couple of years. And it was at that time after we formed POP when I re-engaged Ben Chavis, and he asked me to leave my job at AT&T and come and work for him at the Commission for Racial Justice of the United Church of Christ. And I did, and it was one of the best things I ever did. And one of the projects we had was this Freedom Ride, where we actually literally got in a bus in New York and came down the East Coast of the United States through Washington, D.C., through the South, going to all the significant places, you know, many, I won't say all, but many of the significant places where major events related to the civil rights movement occurred. And that was very important. And it's really interesting because we're coming up on the September 15th, which will be the anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. And that was one of the places that I went on that Freedom Ride. And I was able to meet the father of Deborah McNair, one of the four girls that was killed in that church. And although I had known, you know, because we read about these things before I came to Princeton, during Princeton, but to actually go to these places and to meet people associated with those events gave me a greater clarity, and I think deepened my understanding of these events and really of the civil rights movement. So it was a very valuable experience. I worked for the Commission for Racial Justice for about 5 years, and then because the United Church of Christ moved its corporate headquarters out of New York back to Cleveland, I couldn't make that move at that time because my mother was very ill. So I decided to leave the commission. And at that time, I actually ended up working in the state legislature of Newark. I worked for 2 years as a research associate until the Democrats lost the majority in the state legislature. But it was very valuable, not only valuable because of the Freedom Ride, but because Ben Chavis also enabled me to work on building the People's Organization for Progress. I think that is one of the reasons why we have celebrated our 38th anniversary, because he really helped me do that work that I needed to lay a firm foundation so that POP could continue for some decades.
Well, Larry, let's fast forward now to your Democratic senatorial campaign against Cory Booker, okay? Right. So when we talked the other day, you mentioned that you actually had started your campaign prior to COVID hitting. So you started in December.
Right.
Take us through, if you can, what went on once COVID hit and how you and your campaign had to adjust.
Yes. Well, just quickly, the idea of me running for the U.S. Senate was in the air when Senator Menendez, who was New Jersey's other senator, was on trial for corruption. Now, he was not convicted, but there was significant dissatisfaction, but I really wasn't ready. And then in the spring of 2019, Senator Booker announced that he was going to run for president. And the New Jersey State Legislature had to pass a law that would allow him to keep his seat as senator and run for president. And then the idea started to take root, but I still, you know, didn't announce. And then I was asked to chair I had been a supporter of Bernie Sanders in 16. I was a delegate for Bernie Sanders to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. And then I was asked to chair Bernie Sanders' campaign in New Jersey. And then late in 19, around December, you know, thinking about what we could possibly do to get Bernie more votes in New Jersey and to get him more votes in the African-American community, the idea arose about me running for the U.S. Senate. So I never really like formally announced, like, I'm going to run for Senate. I put out a notice on Twitter and saying that I'm going to have a meeting end of December and people, you know, to talk about possibly running. And then there was an explosion, and I'm not making this up. There was an explosion on social media. My Facebook page was flooded, and, you know, everybody was like, you really should run, you know, because I just wanted to talk about it. But it ended up with me running in January, you know, coming out in January to run. And then the coronavirus crisis broke, and boy, did it throw a boomerang into our plans with regard. First of all, the virus itself took attention away from politics. It shifted everybody's mind, you know, and rightly so, from politics to health. And then the lockdown, when the lockdown came, we couldn't even campaign. We couldn't go door to door. You know, I had to get petition signed. And, you know, the day in March when I took my petitions down, I was scared I was going to get arrested on New Jersey Turnpike. I'm not making this up. Like, there were hardly any cars on the New Jersey Turnpike. And I had like 3,500 signatures. I had to physically get to the Division of Elections in New Jersey. And I'm like looking over my shoulder all the way, worried about if I'm going to get arrested. So there was a lockdown. And there were various things that happened that really made it difficult to campaign. But, you know, we went forward with the campaign, and we didn't win. But I thought we did well, considering the conditions that we were up against, the amount of money that we raised. I got like almost 119,000 votes. And I thought that was good, you know, and a lot of people thought that was good first time out. So it bodes well for future efforts.
So Larry, that was really interesting. And, you know, first of all, we're glad that you didn't get arrested. And second of all, we're glad you didn't get infected during that process. But Right. But with all of that, I mean, how was it to run against a established, well-financed candidate such as Cory Booker, who had the backing of the Democratic National Committee and Wall Street hedge funders? I mean, you know, the little lady across the street that he helped, you know, when there was snowfall and he dug her out of her front door. I mean, what was it like to have to manage against a candidate like that?
It was challenging, but it was exciting. I'm glad I did it. And I need to thank Senator Sanders because I believe that his campaign in 16 and his suspended campaign in 20 actually helped open the door for more progressive politics and a radical person like me to run. Had it not been for the Sanders campaign, which clearly identified an entire block of voters in New Jersey who were ready for a progressive platform, one that included, of course, the Green New Deal and doubling the minimum wage and eliminating student debt, and on and on and on, that constituency was identified and was primed by Sanders in 16 and was there for us in 20. And so he helped make that possible. Now, the thing I learned from this election was that it's a money game. It's not that I didn't know that already, right? But how much of a money game it is really became clear to me during this run for Senate. And If I was to do it all over again, I would have started an entire year earlier and had a year's worth of fundraising under my belt by the time I started, because it is a money game. With the little bit of money I raised, I was able to get almost 119,000 votes. If I had raised five times that much, which would have only been about $300,000, I would have been real competition for the incumbent. So it was tough. What was as tough was not just the money, but running against Cory as a representative of what the left would describe as a neoliberal politician. That certainly described Cory Booker up until 2019. But what happened was that Cory's campaign smartly began to try to morph him into a progressive candidate. You know, I mean, at one point, you know, he seemed to be adopting certain positions similar to that of Bernie Sanders. People's Organization for Progress have been raising the issue of reparations since 1982 when we were founded. During the time that Cory Booker was mayor in Newark, he never said anything about it. Then suddenly, in the summer of 2019, he introduced a reparations bill in the Senate. And this replicated itself with various issues. So that posed some challenges in terms of juxtaposing myself against him and trying to show the difference between he and I. And so I had to really go over when I spoke to people, you know, via Zoom and other electronic media, you know, I really had to talk about his history and his record more. So there was the financial challenge, there was the ideological challenge. But if someone said, would you do this again? I certainly would do it again, because we must have people in the mix who are going to push for progressive politics. One thing I learned is, the things that Senator Sanders, the issues that he was campaigning on, guaranteed minimum income, universal health care, these are things that Dr. King talked about in 1968 before he was assassinated. They're in his book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, 19, published in 67. Some of them are in his book, Why We Can't Wait, published in 1964. Why is it we're here 60 years later talking about these same policy proposals because we keep putting people in office who are not really in favor. They sound like they're in favor of these things, but once they're in office, they don't work for these things. We have to put forward a whole new class of elected officials who are gonna, in fact, fight for this agenda for social justice. It's not just a matter of personal differences or personnel. You know, I don't have any personal beef with Cory Booker. It was a question of what platform is best for people who are part of the working class and the middle class, who are in the Black community and the Latino community and other communities of color. What platform is best for them? And we really need people in office who are going to fight for a progressive platform based on social, economic, and racial justice.
Well, Larry, we look forward to either you joining the current squad in Congress or starting your own squad when you get into Congress.
All right. I'd be a male member of this squad.
But more importantly, joining in the roundtable. Looking forward to hearing everyone's comments on the money issue and the morphing of candidates after they decide to run for office. So I'm looking forward to hearing all of your comments on that.
Join us next time for the third and final election conversation, when we will be joined by Teresa Brown, class of 75, a former freeholder in New Jersey.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, follow us on our YouTube channel at Nubian Tigers Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Nubian Tigers as one word. And of course, you can always check us out on our website, NubianTigersPodcast.com. where in addition to the podcast episodes, you can also find helpful resources to help you explore the subject of each podcast. Looking forward to sharing some wisdom with you next time.
Wake up, wake up, wake up.